but a little bit on the bench, and I'll see you in the courtroom.
Whatever.
And remember, you can talk to whoever you want inside about your lawyer, but don't talk to anybody about your case. No one, or it will come back to bite you on the ass. I promise you that. Got it. Good. Arraignment court is the place where the criminal justice system becomes a feeding frenzy, where those who are caught in the net are delivered to market. I stepped out from the holding facility and into a morass of defense lawyers, prosecutors, investigators, and all lines of support staff, all moving in an unchoreographed dance presided over by Judge Mary Elizabeth Mercer. It was her job to make good on the constitutional guarantee to swiftly bring those accused of a crime to court, to be informed of the charges against them, and assigned counsel if they have not made such arrangements themselves. In practice, this meant that each of the accused had but a few minutes before the judge, prior to beginning the long and usually torturous journey through the system. The attorney tables in first appearance court were large boardroom-sized tables, designed so that several lawyers could be seated at once as they prepared for their cases and clients to be called. Still more defense lawyers stood and milled about by the corral to the left of the judge's bench, where defendants were brought in from the holding cells in groups of six at a time. These lawyers would stand with their clients for the reading of the charges and then the scheduling of an arraignment hearing, where the accused would formally enter a plea. To an outsider, and this included those accused of crimes and their families, packed into the wooden pews of the courtroom's gallery, it was hard to keep track of or understand what was going on. They could only know that this was the justice system at work, and that it would now take over their lives. I went to the bailiff's desk, where the custody call list was on a clipboard. The bailiff had crossed out the first 30 names on the list. Judge Mercer was efficiently moving through the morning shift. I saw Andre Lacasse's name next to the number 38. That meant one group of six was ahead of his group, and that gave me time to find a spot to sit down and check my messages. All nine chairs at the defense table were taken. I scanned the line of chairs running along the railing that separated the gallery from the court's work area and spotted one opening. As I made my way to it, I recognized one of the men I would be sitting next to. He wasn't a lawyer. He was a cop, and we had a past history that coincidentally had been brought up that morning at the staff meeting. He recognized me too, and grimaced as I sat down next to him. We spoke in whispers so as not to draw the attention of the judge.
"Well, well, well, if it isn't Mickey Mouth, great courtroom orator and defender of douchebags."
I ignored the shots. I was used to it from cops. "Detective Langford, long time no see." Lee Langford was one of the Glendale PD homicide detectives who investigated the murder of my former investigator, Raoul Levin. The reasons for Langford's grimace and insults and the friction that still obviously existed between us were many. First, Langford seemed to have a genetically bred hatred of all lawyers. Then there was the little rub that came when he wrongly accused me of Levin's murder. Of course, it didn't help our relationship when I eventually proved him wrong by solving the case for him. "You're a long way from Glendale," I offered as I was pulling out my phone. "Don't you guys do your arraignments up there in Glendale Superior?"
"As usual, Holler, you're behind the times. I don't work for Glendale anymore. I retired."
I nodded, like I thought that was a good thing, then smiled. "Don't tell me you went back to the dark side. You working for one of these defense guys?" Langford looked disgusted. "No fucking chance I'd work for one of you creeps. I work for the DA now. And by the way, a seat just opened up at the big table. Why don't you go over there and sit with your own people?" I had to smile. Langford hadn't changed in the 7 years or so since I had seen him. I kind of enjoyed tweaking him. "No, I think I'm good here."
"Wonderful.
What about Detective Sobel? Is she still with the department?" Langford's partner back then was the one I communicated with. She didn't carry around a bag full of biases like he did.
"She's still there, and she's doing well."
"Tell me,
Which one of these fine, upstanding citizens they're traipsing out in bracelets is your client today? Oh, mine will be in the next batch. He's a real winner, though. A pimp accused of killing one of his own girls. It's a heartwarming story, Langford. Langford pressed back into his chair slightly, and I realized I had surprised him. Don't tell me, he said. Lacoste? I nodded. That's right. It's your case, too? A sneer cracked across his face. You bet. And now I'm going to enjoy every minute of it. DA investigators were used for ancillary duties on a case. The primary investigators remained the police detectives who worked the case from the crime scene on. But when the case was filed and shifted from the police department to the prosecutor's office, DA investigators were used to help prep the case for trial. Their duties included locating witnesses, getting them to court, and reacting to defense maneuvers and witnesses and the like. It was a mixed bag of second-tier responsibilities. Their job was to be prepared to do what needed to be done in the run-up to trial. The great majority of DA investigators were former cops, many of whom were retired like Langford. They were double-dippers, collecting a pension from one department and a paycheck from the DA. Nice work if you could get it. The thing that struck me as unusual was that Langford had already been assigned to the Lacoste case. The defendant had not even made a first appearance yet, and Langford was on the case and in the courtroom. I don't get it, I said. They just filed on him yesterday, and you're already assigned? I'm in the homicide division. We get cases on a rotation. This one's mine, and I just wanted to get a look at the guy, see what I'll be dealing with. And now that I know who his lawyer is, I know exactly who I'm dealing with. He stood up and turned to look down at me. I noticed the badge clipped to his belt and the black leather boots he wore below cuffed suit pants. It wasn't a good look, but probably no one wanted to incur his wrath by telling him. This will be fun, he said, and then he walked away. You're not going to wait for him to come out? Langford didn't answer. He walked through the gate and down the center aisle toward the door at the back of the courtroom. After watching him go, I sat still for a few moments, thinking about the veiled threat and the knowledge that I now had to factor in having an investigator with a hard-on for me working for the prosecutor on the case. It was not a good start. My phone buzzed in my hand, and I checked the text. It was from Lorna, and it was a little bit of good news to balance out the Langford episode. The gold brick was real. $52,000 plus deposited in escrow account. We were in business. No matter what happened, at least I was going to get paid. I started to forget about Langford, and then a shadow fell across me, and I looked up to see one of the detention deputies standing over me. You're Holler, right? Yeah, that's me. What's... He showered a stack of business cards down on me. My own cards. The ones I had given Lacoste. You pull that stunt again, and you'll never be allowed back to see one of your scumbag clients. At least not on my watch. I felt my face growing red. Several attorneys were watching us. The only saving grace was that Langford had missed the show. Got it? The deputy asked. Yeah, got it, I said. Good, he said. He walked away, and I started gathering up the cards. Show over. The other lawyers turned and went back to business. Chapter 8. There was only one Lincoln at the curb when I got out of court this time. Everybody else had already split for lunch. I jumped in the back and told Earl to head toward Hollywood. I didn't know where Stacy Campbell lived, but I was guessing it wasn't in downtown. I pulled my phone, looked at the number on my hand, and punched it in. She answered promptly with a practiced voice that was soft and sexy, and everything I assumed was wanted in a prostitute's voice. Hello, this is Starry-Eyed Stacy. Stacy Campbell? The soft and sexy left her voice and was replaced by a harder-edged tone that had a tinge of cigarette to it as well. Who's this? My name is Michael Holler. I'm Andre Lacoste's attorney. He told me he spoke to you and you agreed to talk to me about Giselle Dallinger. The thing is, I don't want to be dragged into court. That's not my intention. I just want to talk to someone who knew Giselle and could tell me about her. There was a silence. Miss Campbell, is there a chance I could come by to see you or meet you somewhere? I'll meet you. I don't want anyone coming here. That's fine. Is now okay? I need to get changed and put on my hair. What time and where? Another silence went by. I was about to tell her she didn't have to put on her hair for me when she spoke first. How about toast? It was 10 past noon, but I understood that a woman of her occupation might have just gotten up for the day. Yeah, that's fine, I guess. I'm trying to think of a place where we could get breakfast. What? No, I mean Toast, the place. It's a cafe on 3rd near Crescent Heights. Oh, okay. I'll meet you there. So about 1, then? I'll be there. I'll get a table and be waiting. I ended the call, told Earl where we were going, and then called Lorna to see if she got my 2 o'clock status conference postponed. No soap, she said. Patricia said the judge wants this thing off his calendar. No more delays, Mickey. He wants you in chambers at 2. Patricia was Judge Compagnoni's clerk. She actually ran the courtroom and the calendar. And when she said the judge wanted to move the case on, it really meant Patricia wanted to move it on. She was tired of the constant delays I had asked for while I tried to convince my client to take the deal the DA had put on the table. I thought for a moment. Even if Stacy Campbell showed up on time, which I knew I couldn't count on, there was probably no way I could get what I needed from her and get back to the courthouse in downtown by 2. I could cancel the meeting at Toast, but I didn't want to. The mysteries and motives surrounding Gloria Dayton had my full attention at the moment. I wanted to know the secrets behind her subterfuge, and diverting to handle another case was not going to happen. Okay, I'll call Bullocks and see if she's still up for covering for me on it. Why, are you still in first appearance court? No, heading to West Hollywood on the Dayton case. You mean the Lacoste case, don't you? Right. And West Hollywood can't wait? No, it can't, Lorna. She still has a hold on you, doesn't she? Even in death. I just want to know what happened, so right now I need to call Bullocks. I'll talk to you later. I clicked off before I got a sermon about getting emotionally involved with the work. Lorna had always had issues with my relationship with Gloria, and could not understand that it had nothing to do with sex, that it wasn't some kind of horror fixation, that it was about finding someone you somehow shared the same view of the world with, or at least thought you did. When I called Jennifer Aronson, she told me she was working in the law library at Southwestern and going through the Gloria Dayton files I had given her that morning. I'm going case to case and just trying to familiarize myself with everything, she said. Unless there's something I should be specifically looking for. Not really, I said. Did you find any notes on Hector Aronde Moya? No notes. It's amazing you remembered his name after 7 years. I remember names, some cases, but not birthdays or anniversaries. Always gets me in trouble. You need to check on Moya's status, and I did that first thing. I started with the LA Times online archives and found a couple stories about his case. It went federal. You said you made your deal with the DA's office, but the feds obviously took over the case. I nodded. The more I talked about a case, the more I remembered it. Right, there was a federal warrant existing. The DA must have gotten big-footed because Moya was papered, and that gave the feds first dibs. It also gave them a bigger hammer. There is a gun enhancement with federal drug trafficking statutes that made Moya eligible for a life sentence, and that's what he got. I remembered that part, too. That this guy was put away for life for having a couple ounces of coke in his hotel room. I'm assuming there was an appeal. Did you check PACER? PACER was the federal government's public access to court electronic records database. It provided quick access to all documents filed in regard to a case. It would be the starting point. Yes,
I went on Pacer and pulled up the docket. He was convicted in 06. Then there was the plenary appeal, the usual global attack citing insufficient evidence, court error on motions, and unreasonable sentencing. None made it past Pasadena. PCA, right down the line. She was referring to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It had a Southern California location on South Grand Avenue in Pasadena. Appeals from Los Angeles-based cases would be filed through the Pasadena courthouse and initially reviewed by a 3-member screening local panel of the appellate court. The local panel weeded out appeals it deemed unworthy and kicked the others for full consideration to a merits panel composed of 3 judges drawn from the circuit that held jurisdiction over the western region of the country. Aronson saying that Moya never made it past Pasadena meant that his conviction was per curiam affirmed by the screening panel of judges. Moya had struck out swinging. His next move was to file a habeas corpus petition in U.S. District Court seeking post-conviction relief, a long-shot move to vacate his sentence. This was like shooting a 3 at the buzzer. The motion would be his last shot at a new trial unless startling new evidence was brought forward. "What about a 2255? I asked, using the U.S. code designation for a habeas petition. "Yup," Aronson said. He went with ineffective assistance of counsel, claiming his guy never negotiated a plea agreement and got blown out on that as well. "Who was the trial attorney?" "Somebody named Daniel Daly. You know him?" "Yeah, I know him. But he's a federal court guy, and I try to stay clear of the Fed. I haven't seen him work, but from what I've heard, he's one of the go-to guys over there." "I actually knew Daly from Four Green Fields, where we both stopped in on Fridays for end-of-the-week martinis." "Well, there wasn't much he or anybody could do with Moya," Jennifer said. "He went down hard and stayed down, and now he's 7 years into a life sentence and not going anywhere." "Where is he?"
"Victorville."
The federal correctional institution at Victorville was 80 miles north and located at the edge of an Air Force base in the desert. It was not a good place to spend the rest of your life. It was set up there that if the desert winds didn't dry you up and blow you away, then the constant earth-shaking sonic booms of the Air Force jets overhead would drive you crazy. I was contemplating this when Aronson spoke again.
"I guess the feds really don't fool around," she said.
"How do you mean?"
"You know, a life sentence for 2 ounces of blow? Pretty harsh."
"Yeah, they're harsh all the way around on sentencing, which is why I don't do federal defense. Don't like telling clients to abandon all hope. Don't like working out a deal with the prosecution, only to have the judge ignore it and drop the hammer on my guy."
"That happens?"
"Too often. I had a guy once. Forget it. Never mind. It's history, and I don't want to dwell on it. What I did dwell on was Hector Aronde Moya, and how a slick deal I made for a client ultimately landed him in Victorville with a life sentence. I hadn't even really bothered to track the case after making the deal with a deputy DA named Leslie Fair. To me, it was just another day in the salt mine. A quick courthouse deal, a hotel name and room number in exchange for a deferral of charges against my client. Gloria Dayton went into a drug rehab program instead of jail, and Hector Aronde Moya went off to federal prison forever. And without knowing who or where the tip to the authorities had come from. Or had he? 7 years had gone by. It seemed beyond the realm of possibility to consider that Moya had reached out from federal prison to exact vengeance on Gloria Dayton. But no matter how far-fetched the idea, it might be useful in the defense of Andre Lacoste. My job would be to make the jury second-guess the prosecution, to make at least one of the gods of guilt think for himself or herself and say, "Hey, wait a minute. What about this guy up there in the desert, rotting in prison because of this woman? Maybe." "Did you see any hearings in the docket on a motion to produce a witness or a motion to suppress based on lack of probable cause? Anything like that?"
"Yes. That was part of the first appeal on court error.
the judge refused a motion to produce any confidential informants in the case.
He was fishing. There was only one CI, and that was Gloria.
What about anything on the docket that is under seal? Did you see anything like that?
Judges usually sealed records pertaining to confidential informants, but the documents themselves were often referenced by number or code on Pacer, so at least one knew that such records existed.
No, Jennifer said, just the PSR.
The pre-sentencing report on Moya. Those were always kept under seal as well. I thought about things for a moment. Okay, I don't want to drop this. I want to see the transcript of that battle over confidential informants and probable cause. You're going to have to go to Pasadena and pull hard files. Who knows, maybe we get lucky and there's something in there we can use. The DEA or FBI had to testify at some point about how they got to that hotel and to that room. I want to know what they said.
You think Gloria's name could have been revealed?
That would be too easy and too careless. But if there is a reference to a specific CI, we might have something to work with. Also, ask for the PSR. Maybe after 7 years they might let you have a look at it.
That's a long shot. Those are supposed to stay sealed forever.
Doesn't hurt to ask.
Well, I can head to Pasadena right now. I'll get back to these Gloria files later.
No, Pasadena can wait. I want you to go downtown instead.
Are you still up for sitting in for me on the Deirdre Ramsey case?
Absolutely.
She practically jumped through the phone.
Don't get too excited, I quickly counseled. Like I said this morning, the case is a dog. You just have to ask the judge for a little bit more time and patience. Tell him we know it's an STD case and we are close to convincing Deirdre that it's in her very best interest to take the state's offer and get this behind her. And you have to persuade Shelley Albert, the prosecutor, to keep the offer on the table another couple of weeks. That's it. Just another couple weeks is all, okay? The offer was for Ramsey to plead to aiding and abetting and to testify against her boyfriend and his partner in the robbery. In exchange, she'd get a 3 to 5 year sentence. With gain time and time already served, she'd be out in a year.
I can do that, Jennifer said. But I'll probably skip the SIF reference, if you don't mind.
What?
Syphilis. You call it an STD case? Sexually transmitted disease?
I smiled and looked out the window. We were cruising through Hancock Park. It was all big houses, big lawns, and tall hedges. Jennifer, I didn't mean that. STD is shorthand from my days at the public defenders. It means straight to disposition. When I was with the PD 20 years ago, that's how we divided our caseloads. STDs and STTs. Straight to dispo or straight to trial. Maybe now they call them STPs, straight to plea, to avoid confusion.
Oh, well, now I'm embarrassed.
Not as much as you'd be if you'd said to Judge Compagnoni that the case has syphilis. We both laughed at that. Jennifer had one of the brightest and hungriest legal minds I had ever encountered, but she was still gaining practical experience and learning the routine and language of the criminal beat. I knew that if she stuck with it, she would eventually become the state's worst nightmare when she walked into court.
Couple more things, I said, getting back to business.
Try to walk into chambers ahead of Shelley and grab the seat that will put you on the judge's left.
Okay, she said hesitantly. Why?
It's a left brain, right brain thing. People are more agreeable toward people on their left.
Come on.
I mean it. Whenever I stand in front of a jury for closing argument, I move as far right as I can get. So for most of them, I'm coming from their left.
That's crazy.
Try it. You'll see.
It's impossible to prove.
I'm telling you, there have been scientific tests and studies. You can Google it.
I don't have time. What was the other thing?
If you start feeling comfortable enough with the judge, tell him that what will really help us put this to bed is if Shelley drops cooperation from the plea agreement. If Deirdre doesn't have to testify against her boyfriend, I think we can make this happen. We're even willing to keep the same sentencing terms, just no cooperation. And tell the judge that Shelley doesn't need it. She has all three of them on wiretaps talking about the whole thing.
And she's got the DNA from the rape kit matching to the boyfriend. It's a slam dunk even without Deirdre's testimony. She does not need Deirdre.
Okay, I'll try. But I was sort of hoping this might be my first criminal trial.
You don't want this to be your first trial. You want that one to be a winner. Besides, 80% of criminal law is figuring out how to stay out of trial. And the other half is all mental.
Yeah, I get that.
Good luck.
Thanks, boss.
Don't call me boss. We're associates, remember?
Right.
I put the phone away and started thinking about how I would handle the interview with Stacy Campbell. We were passing the farmer's market now, and we're almost there. After a while, I noticed that Earl kept looking at me in the rear view. He did this when he had something to say.
"What's up, Earl?"
I finally asked.
"I was wondering about what you said on the phone, about with people on the left side and how that works."
"Yeah.
Well, one time, you know, back when I was working the streets, I had this guy come up with a gun to rip off my stash."
"Yeah?"
"And the thing was, back then somebody was going around popping guys for their cash and stash, you know? Just popping them in the head and grabbing it all up. And I was thinking that this was the guy, and he was about to do me."
"Scary. What happened?"
"Well, I talked him out of it. I just talked about my daughter just being born and all. I gave him my stuff and he just ran away. Then later, there was an arrest in those other murders, and I saw his picture on the TV, and it was the guy. The guy that ripped me off."
"You got lucky there, Earl." He nodded and looked at me in the mirror again.
"And the thing is, he was on my right, and I was on his left when he came up, and I talked him out of it. It's kind of like what you were saying there, like he agreed with me not to kill my ass."
I nodded knowingly. "You make sure you tell Bullocks that story next time you see her."
"I will."
"All right, Earl. I'm glad you talked him out of it."
"Yeah, me too. My mom's and daughter, too."
Chapter 9. I got to Toast early, waited 10 minutes for a table, and then kept it while nursing a coffee for 45 minutes. There was a line of West Hollywood hipsters who weren't happy about me monopolizing a coveted table and not even ordering a meal. I kept my head down and read email until starry-eyed Stacy showed up at 1:30 and slid into the chair across from me, enveloped in a strong cloud of perfume. The hair Stacy had put on was a white blonde spike wig with blue highlights at the tips. It went with her so pale it was almost blue skin and the wide stripes of glitter paint on her eyelids. I figured that the hipsters who hated me for taking one of their tables were close to rabid about me now. Starry-eyed Stacy didn't exactly fit in. She looked like she had escaped from a 1970s glam rock album cover.
"So you're the lawyer," she said.
I smiled all businesslike. "That's me."
"Glenda told me about you. She said you were sweet. She didn't say handsome, too."
"Who's Glenda?"
"Giselle. When we first met in Vegas, she was Glenda the Good Witch DeVille."
"Why'd she change her name when she came here?"
She shrugged. "People change, I guess. She was still the same girl. That's why I always called her Glenda."
"So you had already come out from Vegas and she followed?"
"Something like that. We'd stayed in touch, you know. She checked to see how tricks were out here and whatnot. I told her to come out if she wanted to, and she did."
"And you put her in touch with Andre?"
"Yeah, to set her up online and take her bookings."
"How long had you known Andre?"
"Not so long. You think we can get any service around here?"
She was right. The waitress who had so attentively asked me every 5 minutes if I was going to order something was now nowhere to be seen. My guess was that Stacy had that effect on people, especially women. I got the attention of a busboy and told him to fetch our waitress. "How did you find Andre?" I asked while we waited.
"That was easy. I went online and started looking at other girls' sites. He was the site administrator on a lot of the good ones, so I emailed him and we hooked up."
"How many sites does he manage?"
"I don't know. You gotta ask him."
Did you ever know Andre to be physically abusive to any of the women he managed? She snickered.
You mean like a real pimp?
I nodded.
No. When he wants to get rough, he knows people who can do the rough stuff for him.
Like who?
I don't know any names. I just know he's not that physical.
And there were a few times when some guy was trying to chip off his deal and he had to put a stop to it. At least that's what he told me.
You mean guys trying to take over the online stuff?
Yeah, like that.
You know who they were?
No, I don't know names or anything. Just what Andre told me.
What about the guys who do the rough stuff for him? You ever see those guys?
I saw them once when I needed them. Some guy wouldn't pay, and I called Andre when the John was in the shower. His guys showed up like that. She snapped her fingers.
They made him pay, all right.
The guy thought that because he was on some show on cable that nobody ever heard of, he didn't have to pay.
Everybody pays.
The waitress finally came back to the table. Stacy ordered a BLT on what else? Toast and a Diet Coke. I went with chicken salad on a croissant and switched from coffee to iced tea.
Who was Glenda hiding from? I asked as soon as we were alone again.
Stacy handled the jump cut in direction pretty casually.
Isn't everybody hiding from somebody or something?
I don't know. Was she?
She never talked about it, but she looked over her shoulder a lot, if you know what I mean. Especially when she came back here.
This wasn't getting anywhere. What did she tell you about me?
She said that when she lived out here before, you were her lawyer. But she could never call you again if she took a bust.
The waitress put down our drinks, and I waited until she was gone.
Why couldn't she call me?
I don't know. Because it would all unravel, I guess.
That wasn't the answer I expected. I thought that she would say that Glenda could never call me because it would expose her betrayal. Unravel, was that her word?
That's what she said, yeah.
What did she mean by that?
I don't know, she just said things. She said it could unravel. I don't know what it meant, and she didn't say any more about it.
Stacy was starting to act put out by the questioning. I leaned back and thought about things. Besides offering a few tantalizing words with no further explanation, she wasn't much help. I guess I'd been foolish to think Gloria Dayton, if that was even her real name, had confided in another prostitute about her distant past. All I knew now was that the whole thing depressed me. Gloria, Glenda, Giselle had been inextricably bound to the life. She was unable to leave it, and it eventually took everything away from her. It was an old story, and in a year's time it would be forgotten or replaced by the next one. Our food came, but I had lost my appetite. I watched starry-eyed Stacy put globs of mayonnaise on her BLT and eat it like a little girl, licking her fingers after the first bite, and that didn't lift my spirits either. Chapter 10. I sat in the back seat for a long time thinking about things. Earl kept looking at me in the rear view, wondering when I would give him directions. But I didn't know where to go next. I thought about waiting for Stacy Campbell to come out of the restaurant after using the restroom and following her home so I knew where she lived, but I knew Cisco could run her down if I needed her again. I checked my watch and saw it was 2:45. Bullocks was probably in the middle of things with a status conference in Judge Campagnoni's chambers. I decided to wait a while before checking in with her. "The Valley, Earl," I finally said. "I want to go watch practice." Earl turned the ignition and we were off. He took Laurel Canyon up the mountain to Mulholland Drive. We turned west and after a few curves, came to the parking lot entrance for Fryman Canyon Park. Earl pulled into a space, opened the glove box, and handed the binoculars over the seat to me. I took off my jacket and tie and left them on the back seat as I got out. "I'll probably be a half hour or so," I said.
"I'll be here," he said.
I closed the door and walked off. Fryman Canyon descends the northern slope of the Santa Monica Mountains,
all the way down into Studio City. I took the Betty Deering Trail down until it split east and west. This is where I went off the trail and farther down through the brush until I reached a promontory with open views of the sprawling city below. My daughter had transferred this year to the Skyline School, and its campus backed up from Valley Crest Drive to the edge of the park. The campus was on two elevations. The lower level contained the academic buildings, and the upper side was where the sports complex was located. By the time I got to the viewing spot, soccer practice was already underway below. I scanned the field with the binoculars and found Haley in the far goal. She was the team's starting goalkeeper, which was an improvement over her previous school, where she was second string. I sat on a large rock I had pulled up from the ground and positioned on a previous visit to the spot. After a while, I let the binoculars hang around my neck, and I just watched with my elbows on my knees, face in my hands. She was denying everything until one shot with a perfect shape to it got by her, hit the crossbar, and then was put in on the rebound. The bottom line was that she looked like she was having fun, and the concentration of the position likely crowded out all other thoughts. I wished that I could do that. Just forget about Sandy and Katie Patterson and everything else for a while, especially at night when I close my eyes to sleep. I could have gone to court to force the issue with my daughter, make a judge order visitation, and compel her to stay with me every other weekend and every other Wednesday like it used to be. But I knew that would only make things worse. You do that to a 16-year-old, and you could lose her forever. So I let her go and began a waiting game, waiting and watching from afar. I had to have faith that Haley would eventually come to realize that the world was not black and white, that it was gray, and the gray area was where her father dwelled. It was easy for me to keep that faith because there was no other choice. But it was not so easy to face the larger question that floated above that faith like a storm cloud. The question of how you can hope and expect someone to forgive you when deep down you don't forgive yourself. My phone buzzed, and I took a call from Bullocks, who had just left the courthouse downtown. How did it go? I think good. Shelley Albert wasn't happy about it, but the judge pressed her on the cooperation component of the disposition, and she finally caved. So we have a deal if we can sell it to Deirdre. As it was a status conference in camera, Ramsey hadn't been required to be there. We would have to visit the jail and present the new terms of the offer from the DA. Good. How long do we have? Basically 48 hours. She's giving us till close of shop Friday, and the judge wants to hear from us on Monday. Okay, then we go see her tomorrow. I'll introduce you to her and you can sell her on it. Sounds good. Where are you? I hear yelling. I'm at soccer practice. Really? You and Haley have patched things up? That's fan... Not exactly. I'm just watching. So what's your next move? I guess I go back to the law library and hit those files. I think it's probably too late to go out to Pasadena to pull transcripts. All right, well, I'll let you get back to it. Thanks for taking Ramsey for me. Happy to. I really liked it, Mickey. I want more criminal. I'm sure that can be arranged. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Oh, one other thing. You got another second? Sure, what? I sat to the judge's left, like you said, and you know, I think it worked. He patiently listened to me every time I spoke, and he kept cutting Shelley off every time she responded. I could have mentioned that the judge's attentiveness might have had something to do with Jennifer Aronson's being an attractive, energetic, and idealistic 26-year-old, and Shelley Albert's being a lifer in the DA's office, who seemed to carry the burden of proof in her slumped shoulders and permanent frown. See, I told you, I said instead. Thanks for the tip, she said. Talk to you tomorrow. After I put the phone away, I used the binoculars again to watch my daughter. The coach called the practice at 4, and the girls were leaving the field. Because Haley was a transfer, she was treated like a rookie, and she had to gather all the balls and put them in a net bag, During the practice, she had been in a goal that faced my position, so I didn't see her back until she started gathering up the balls. My heart lifted when I saw she still had the number 7 on the back of her green jersey. Her lucky number. My lucky number. Mickey Mantle's number. She hadn't changed it, and that was at least one connection to me she hadn't changed. I took that as a sign that not everything between us was lost, and that I should continue to keep the faith. Part 2. Mr. Lucky. Tuesday, April 2nd. Chapter 11. There is never just one case. There are always many. I liken the practice of law to the craft of some of the premier buskers seen working the crowds on the Venice boardwalk. There's the man who spins plates on sticks, keeping a forest of china spinning with momentum and aloft at the same time. And there's the man who juggles gas-powered chainsaws, spinning them in the air in a precise manner so that he never shakes hands with the business end of the blades. Aside from the Lacoste case, I kept several plates spinning as the calendar changed from one year to the next. Leonard Watts, the carjacker, got a deal he grudgingly agreed to in order to head off a retrial. Jennifer Aronson handled the negotiations, just as she did with Deirdre Ramsey, who took a plea deal and did not have to testify against her boyfriend in court. I picked up a high-profile case in late December that was more of the chainsaw variety. A former client and lifelong con artist named Sam Scales was popped by the LAPD on a scam that brought new meaning to the words heartless predator. Scales was accused of setting up a phony website and Facebook page in order to solicit donations to cover the burial costs of a child killed in a school massacre in Connecticut. People from far and wide gave liberally, and Scales was said by the prosecution to have raked in close to $50,000 that donors believed was going toward a murdered child's funeral. The scam worked well until the parents of the dead child got wind of the effort and contacted the authorities. Scales had used a variety of false digital fronts to safeguard his identity, but eventually, as in all scams, he needed to move the money to a place where he could access it and put it in his pocket. And that was the Bank of America branch on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. When he strolled in and asked for the money in cash, the bank teller saw the flag on the account and stalled while police were called. It was explained to Sam that the bank did not keep that much money in cash on hand because it was in a high-risk location, meaning the chances of a robbery were higher than at other locations. Scales was told that he could wait for the money to be special ordered and put on the regular 3 p.m. armored truck delivery, or he could go to a downtown location where that kind of cash was more readily available. Scales, a con artist who didn't know a con when it was directed at him, elected to special order the money and returned to pick it up. When he came back at 3, he was met by 2 detectives with the LAPD Commercial Crimes Division, the same 2 detectives who arrested him for the last case I defended him on, a Japanese tsunami aid ripoff. Everybody wanted a piece of Scales this time. The FBI, the Connecticut State Police, even the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who jumped in on the case because several of the victims who had given money were from across the border. But the LAPD made the arrest, and that meant the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office had the first shot at him. Scales called me, as he had in the past, and I took on the cause of a man so vilified in the media for his alleged crime that he had to be placed in solitary at Men's Central for fear he would be harmed by other prisoners. What made matters worse for Scales was that the outrage was so great that the district attorney himself, Damon Kennedy, the man who had soundly defeated me in the prior year's election, had announced that he would personally prosecute Scales to the full extent of the law. This, of course, came after I signed on as defense counsel, and now the stage was set for Kennedy to once again trounce me on the public stage. I had made inquiries about a disposition. The DA had Scales dead to rights on this one, but Kennedy was having none of that. He knew he had a slam-dunk case and there was no need to deal. He would milk the trial for every last video, print, and digital drop of attention he could wring out of it. No doubt, Sam Scales was going to go down for the full count this time. The Scales case did not help me personally either. LA Weekly ran a cover story on the most hated man in America, and the report provided a trip down memory lane of the many cons Scales had been accused of over the past two decades. My name came up often in these vignettes as his longtime defense attorney, and the overall story cast me as an official apologist for my client. The issue landed a week before Christmas, and it made for an icy reception from my daughter, who once again believed her father had publicly humiliated her. All parties had previously agreed that I would be allowed to visit on Christmas morning with gifts for both daughter and former wife, but it didn't go so well. What I had hoped would be the start of a winter thaw in both relationships turned into an ice storm. I ate a TV dinner at home alone that night. It was now the first week of April, and I was appearing on behalf of Andre Lacoste before the Honorable Nancy Lego in Department 120 of the Downtown Criminal Courts building. We were 6 weeks out from trial on the case, and Lego was taking testimony in regard to the motion to suppress that I had filed shortly after the preliminary hearing in which Lacoste was held to answer. Lacoste sat beside me at the defense table. He had been in jail going on 5 months now, and the pallor of his skin was just one indication of the deterioration within. Some people can handle a stint behind bars. Andre wasn't one of them. As he told me often when we communicated, he was losing his mind in captivity. Through the exchange of discovery materials that began in December, I had received a copy of the video of Andre Lacoste's interview with the lead investigator on the Gloria Dayton murder. My motion to suppress claimed that the interview was actually an interrogation and that the police had used trickery and coercion to elicit incriminating statements from my client. Additionally, the motion claimed that the detective who interrogated Lacoste in a small windowless room at West Bureau ran roughshod over his constitutional rights, not properly administering the Miranda warning regarding his right to an attorney until after Lacoste had made the incriminating statements and was placed under arrest. During the interrogation, Lacoste had denied killing Dayton, which was good for our side. But what was bad was that he had given police evidence of motive and opportunity. He admitted that he had been in the victim's apartment on the night of the murder, and that he and Gloria had argued about the money she was supposed to have been paid by the client at the Beverly Wilshire. He even acknowledged that he had grabbed Gloria by the throat. Of course, this evidence Lacoste had provided against himself was pretty damning, and it served as the core of the DA's case, as demonstrated in the preliminary hearing. But now, I was asking the judge to eliminate the interview from the case and not allow a jury to see it. In addition to the intimidation practices employed by the detective in the room, Lacoste had not been read his rights until after he had mentioned that he had been in Dayton's apartment in the hours before her death and that there had been an argument. Motions to suppress are always the longest of long shots, but this one was worth a try. If I got the video of the interrogation kicked, the entire case would change. It might even tilt in Andre Lacoste's direction. The prosecution, led by Deputy DA William Forsyth, began the hearing with Detective Mark Witten's testimony about the circumstances of the interview, and then introduced the video recording of the session. The 32-minute video was shown in its entirety on a screen mounted to the wall opposite the courtroom's empty jury box. I had already watched it numerous times. I had my video time counts and questions ready when Forsyth finished his direct examination of Witten and turned the witness and the remote control over to me. Witten knew what was coming. I had laid into him pretty good when he had testified during the preliminary hearing. This time, the assault would take place in front of Judge Lego, who was assigned to hear the case after the prelim. There was no jury to play to, no gods of guilt. I remained seated at the defense table, my client in his orange jumpsuit next to me. Detective Witten, good morning. I said as I pointed the remote at the screen. I want to go back to the very beginning of the interrogation.
Good morning, Witten said, and it was an interview, not an interrogation. As I said before, Mr. Lacoste voluntarily agreed to come to the station to talk with me.
Right, I heard that, but let's take a look at this. I started playing the video, and on the screen, the door to the interview room opened and Lacoste entered, followed by Witten, who put his hand on my client's shoulder to direct him to one of the two chairs on either side of a small table. I stopped the playback as soon as Lacoste was seated.
So, detective, what are you doing there with your hand on Mr. Lacoste's upper arm?
I was just directing him to a seat. I wanted to sit down for the interview.
You were directing him to that particular chair, though, correct?
Not really.
You wanted him facing the camera because your plan was to draw a confession from him, correct?
No, not correct.
Are you telling Judge Lego that you did not want him in that particular seat so that he would be in view of the hidden camera that was in that room?
Witten took a few moments to compose an answer. Bullshitting a jury is one thing, but it grows increasingly risky to mislead a judge who has been around the block a few times. It's standard policy and practice to place the interview subject in the seat facing the camera. I was following policy.
Is it standard policy and practice to videotape interviews with subjects who have come to the police department for a conversation, as you put it in your direct testimony?
Yes, it is.
I raised my eyebrows in surprise, but then reminded myself that it wasn't serving my client well to bullshit the judge either. This would include feigning surprise at an answer I knew was coming. I moved on.
And you insist that you had not classified Mr. Lacoste as a suspect when he came to the police station to talk to you?
Absolutely. I had a completely open mind about him.
So there was no need to give him the standard rights warning at the top of this so-called conversation?
Forsyth objected, saying the question was already asked and answered during his direct examination. Forsyth was mid-30s and lean. With a ruddy complexion and sandy hair, he looked like a surfer in a suit.
Judge Lego overruled the objection and let me go with it. Witten answered the question.
I didn't believe it was necessary, he said. He was not a suspect at the time he voluntarily came into the station and then voluntarily entered that room for the interview. I was just going to take a statement from him, and he ended up saying he had been in the victim's apartment. I was not expecting that.
He delivered the answer just as I'm sure he had rehearsed it with Forsyth. I moved ahead in the video to a point where Witten excused himself from the room to go get my client a soda that the detective had offered. I froze the image of Lacoste left alone in the room.
Detective, what would have happened if my client had decided while alone in there that he had to use the restroom and got up to leave?
I don't understand. We would have allowed him to use the restroom. He never asked.
But what would have happened if he'd decided on his own to get up from the table at this point here and open that door? Yes or no, did you lock it when you left the room?
It's not a yes or no answer.
I think it is. Forsyth objected and called my response badgering. The judge told the detective to answer the question the way he saw fit.
Witten composed himself again and fell back on the standard out. Policy.
It is the policy of the department not to allow any citizen unescorted access to work areas of police stations. That door leads directly to the detective bureau, and it would have been against policy for me to allow him to wander through the squad unattended.
Yes, I locked the door.
Thank you, detective. So let me see if I have this right so far. Mr. Lacoste was not a suspect in your case, but he was locked in this windowless room and was under constant surveillance while in there, correct?
I don't know if I would call it surveillance.
Then what would you call it?
We roll the camera whenever someone is in one of those rooms. It's standard policy.
Yes, I know. Let's move on.
I fast-forwarded through the video about 20 minutes, to a point where Witten stood up from his seat and took off his jacket and draped it over the backrest. He then moved his chair in toward the table and stood behind it, leaning forward with his hands on the table.
So you don't know anything about her murder, is that what you're saying?
he said to Lacoste on the screen. I froze it right there.
Detective Whitten, why did you take your jacket off at this point in the interrogation?
You mean the interview?
I took my jacket off because it was getting stuffy in there.
But you testified on direct that the camera was hidden in the air conditioning vent. Wasn't the air on?
I don't know if it was on or not. I hadn't checked before we went in there.
Aren't these so-called interview rooms nicknamed hot boxes by detectives? Because they are used to sweat suspects and hopefully induce them to cooperate and confess?
I've never heard that, no.
You've never used that phrase yourself to describe this room? I pointed to the screen and asked the question with such surprise in my tone that I hoped Whitten would think I had something up my sleeve that he didn't know about. But it was a bluff, and the detective parried it by using a standard witness out. I don't recall ever using the phrase, no.
Okay, so you took your jacket off and are now standing over Mr. Lacoste. Was that to intimidate him?
No, it was because I felt like standing. We had been sitting at that point for a long time.
Do you have hemorrhoids, detective?
Forsythe quickly objected again and accused me of trying to embarrass the detective. I told the judge I was simply trying to place on the record testimony that would help the court understand why the detective felt compelled to stand during the interview after only 20 minutes. The judge sustained the objection and told me to proceed without asking the witness questions of such a personal nature.
Okay, detective, I said. What about Mr. Lacoste? Could he stand up if he wanted to? Could he have stood over you while you were sitting?
I would not have objected, Whitten answered. I hoped the judge was aware that Whitten's answers were largely bogus and part of the dance detectives engaged in every day in every police station. They walked a constitutional tightrope, trying to push things as far as they could before having to enlighten the hapless saps who sat across the table from them. I had to make a case that this was a custodial interrogation and that under these circumstances, Andre Lacoste did not feel that he was free to leave. If the judge was convinced, then she would hold that Lacoste was indeed under arrest when he entered that interrogation room and should have been Mirandized. She could then throw the entire video recording out, crippling the DA's case. I pointed up to the screen again. Let's talk about what you're wearing there, detective. I took Whitten through a full description for the record of the shoulder holster and Glock he was wearing, and then moved down to his belt, eliciting descriptions of the handcuffs, extra gun clip, badge, and pepper spray canister that were attached to it. Your displaying of all of these weapons to Mr. Lacoste was for what purpose? Whitten shook his head like he was annoyed with me. No purpose. It was warm in there, and I took off my jacket. I wasn't displaying anything. So you are telling the court that showing my client your gun and badge and the extra bullets and the pepper spray were not a means of intimidating Mr. Lacoste?
That's exactly what I'm telling the court.
How about at this point? I moved the video forward another minute to the point that Whitten pulled the chair out from the table and put one foot up on it so he could really loom over the small table and Lacoste, who was shorter and more slightly built.
I was not intimidating him, Whitten said. I was having a conversation with him.
I checked the notes on my legal pad and made sure I had covered everything I wanted to get on the record. I didn't think Lego would rule my way on this one, but I thought I had a shot on appeal. Meantime, I had gotten in another round with Whitten on the witness stand. It better prepared me for trial, when I would really need to go at him. Before ending the cross-examination, I leaned over and conferred with Lacoste as a general courtesy. Anything I missed?